Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. They happen to be the views of our guests, which I may or may not agree with. But this evening we're going to have a gentleman we've had on before. His name is Douglas Dietrich. He was a librarian at the Presidio in San Francisco, military Presidio, and he had an opportunity of going through the extensive military files that were there. Now, of course, one of the things was that there was at that time a Colonel Michael Aquino in the military. He was an acknowledged Satanist. He was deeply involved with the occult. He actually was appointed by the military to actually write a chaplain's manual for all the chaplains in the military, the Christian chaplains, the Catholic chaplains, the Jewish chaplains. Why would they actually get a man who was deeply involved in the occult to write the manual for all of the chaplains? Well, you must understand, ladies and gentlemen, as we pointed out, we are ruled by a small little clique that has their people planted within the military, within our banking system. They control our six major banks, within our major corporations, controlling both political parties, the educational system, the people planted within the churches, and certainly people who control the six major media outlets in the United States. And as a result of that, of course, we certainly have a small group who controls America and makes mockery of the electoral process and uses the financial and military power of the United States and is using the financial and military power of the United States to bring about a world government. And when you understand that, you could understand why they would have a man who is deeply involved in the occult, who is a Satanist, actually write the military manual for the, at least according to Douglas, for the chaplains, all of the chaplains. Douglas, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Yes, thank you, sir, for having me. It's an honor to be with your audience, and very glad to be here. Would you like me to start addressing specifically the Chaplain's Handbook?
Why don't you address the Chaplain's Handbook, and then just sort of pick up your story. Now, of course, you told us about the flu epidemic. You'd mentioned that there were 100 million people who died of the flu across the country, across the world. The original figure was 20 million. They've simply been, in recent years, increasing the number of people they say died of the flu, but there's no question that as many people died of influenza at the end of World War I as died in the war, both civilian and military. And I've always suspected that somehow this was a contrived epidemic. But you pick up the story.
Yes, sir. Well, in terms of Satanism and the motivations of Satanism in the military-industrial complex, it's important to remember that the officer class is very different from the class of enlisted men. An enlisted man going all the way up to a non-commissioned officer status, which would be like what my father held in the Navy as a chief petty officer, is basically, per the Uniform Code of Military Justice, if you're not getting paid, theoretically you don't have to fight. So they were always looked on as kind of mercenaries by the officer class, which is why when George Washington, at the end of America's longest declared war, until the Second World War, which was the American Revolutionary War, which lasted 8 years. When he had his opportunity for a Gettysburg Address, he gave no credit whatsoever to the enlisted men who had fought for the independence of the American Republic. Rather, he only credited his officers, because the officer class, from lieutenant all the way up to general, basically holds
that thought. Hold that thought.
Yes, sir.
go right ahead now, but what? Didn't he appreciate the sacrifice that the soldiers had made for really to try to obtain the freedom of this country? Weren't many of the enlisted men dedicated to this concept of individual freedom?
Many absolutely were, and many made the ultimate sacrifice, and many made a sacrifice that was equally grave, which was loss of limb, if not of life. So there were many crippled and very impacted veterans in terms of health. And this is ultimately what led to Shay's Rebellion. And Shay's Rebellion was ultimately put down, and these were enlisted men who instigated a revolution of their own to try and demand compensation for their time in service to the creation and establishment of a new republic. And it was this kind of, and when they were put down, all of the ringleaders were hanged, and many of the their followers were executed. So there is a brutal side to the establishment of the American Republic, which is generally not known, and there is generally a contempt for anyone beneath the officer class that has led to even more of a cliquish or kind of almost cultic behavior amongst the officer class. This is what ultimately led to the subversion of the officer class, which, again, to clarify, the officers' class has to continue fighting whether they're paid or not because they own stock in the nation, as if the nation were a corporation. That is the difference between the commissioned officer and the non-commissioned enlisted man or non-commissioned officer going up to the level of master sergeant, say, for instance, in the Army or Marine Corps. But in terms of Colonel Aquino and how he made his conquest in the Army, or his series of conquests which so subverted the Army, he was coming into play at a period of time when the Army was at its absolute weakest in terms of infrastructure due to the Vietnam War, the enormous ravages that the Vietnam War basically incepted into the condition and the infrastructure of the Army because of the decimation of the officer corps through fragging, and which I've given out the numbers before, which many people have contested, and I always bring up the fact that keep in mind that the numbers that you see are so astronomically whittled down by the military-industrial complex in terms of their accounting, people do not know how catastrophic that the Vietnam War truly was. There were many, many women who died in the Vietnam War, for instance. There is only one nurse's name on the Vietnam Memorial Wall. And if they're cutting down the nurses and their deaths, their fatalities, by literally, the ratio is astronomical. I know of at least 68 to 70 military women or non-military women who were involved with military services who died in Vietnam. They've cut that down to one. Think of what that they've done to the male.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Douglas certainly was a military historian. He worked certainly at the library there at the Presidio. He was talking about Vietnam and the impact this had on our society, it had on our military, it had on our officer corps, and pointed out that the figures that we've gotten are not necessarily true. He comments that there's the only name of only one woman who is on the wall there, the Vietnam Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C., and yet he knows that certainly 50 or 60 women who actually died associated with their service in Vietnam, whose names should be posted there, and they're not. Why would they leave the names of the women off the wall, Douglas?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily sexism per se. As bad as they were to the woman, I believe that they were equally disservicing the men. And my point in bringing up the fact that while you had so many women that were dying, including 38 who died at once in Operation Baby Lift, which was part of SPOVO, the Support for Vietnamese Orphans, where in 1975 they were bringing many hundreds of Vietnamese who were of Amerasian descent, half American, half Asian. They were bringing them over here, literally infants in shoeboxes by the hundreds on heavy military cargo transport planes. One of those planes was sabotaged with a bomb when it took off from the Saigon airport, and when it blew, hundreds of babies died. Literally was raining burning infants from the sky. 38 nurses died on that plane as well.
Of course, that was really after the war had ended, so I could understand why their names wouldn't necessarily be on the wall. The war officially ended, I think, in 74, but something like that. But anyway,
yes.
Basically, of course, certainly we know that there were hundreds, if not more, certainly American servicemen who were abandoned in Vietnam. And that has been totally covered up. They've had all sorts of congressional hearings. In fact, the people who headed those hearings in Washington, D.C., were two United States senators. One was a man named John McCain, who was allowed to run for the presidency. The other was a man named Senator John Kerry. He also was allowed to run for the presidency. Both of them, of course, John McCain was a traitor, went over to the North Vietnamese, and made all sorts of propaganda pictures for them. Of course, the CIA bought those up so that John McCain had never been exposed for the traitor that he was. And I don't even know whether John Kerry ever even served in the military. But basically, of course, so much of the truth of what's gone on has been suppressed. The fact that those prisoners were left, they were totally abandoned by our government. And that, of course, is the invisible government. Most Americans would be horrified to understand that we knew we were sacrificing those men. We left there to rot in those tropical prisons. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. And I want to reconfirm and affirm everything that Dr. Stanley Montes is saying about both John Kerry and Senator John McCain. Yes, everything he says about them is true, and then some. Without diverging too much into the story, my main point about the accounting was that whether it took place after 1973 with Nixon's Vietnamization of the war or before, there were many more women in particular. It's easier to cite them because their numbers are so much smaller. But my point is that when you count how many of those died in the Vietnam conflict as opposed to those that are honored on the wall, the same goes for the men. There literally should be well over 500,000 men whose names are on the Vietnam Memorial Wall.
Well, now, wait a minute. You're not suggesting that 500,000 men died in the war.
Keep in mind that many of them died as a direct result of being in theater and exposed to Agent Orange, defoliants.
All right, fine. So certainly they were poisoning our men. They lied about Agent Orange. Incidentally, John Kerry was in the Navy. He did apparently run a PT boat up the river there, but he only served for a relatively few months in Vietnam, got himself three Purple Hearts, and then came home. He wasn't going to take a chance on staying over there getting killed because he knew the war was phony. He knew that we were financing the North Vietnamese. All during that war, we were financing the Russians, the Russians were financing the North Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese were financing the Viet Cong, were killing our boys. It was like World War II all over again. Go right ahead.
Yes, sir. And in terms of my point concerning the fatalities that occur in theater where the death occurs afterwards, injuries that occur in theater are not counted in theater. There's a difference in the military and in hospitals between casualties and fatalities. So when someone suffers a casualty, then it's just, quote-unquote, an injury. Many casualties die outside of theater. So with that in mind, hopefully people understand there was a greater decimation of officers as well as enlisted men in the Vietnam War. And because of the fragging, it was far more dangerous to be an officer than it was in any other war in American history.
How many officers were actually killed by fragging? You know, for fragging, people who don't know, this is certainly when an enlisted man would certainly throw a hand grenade or something into a tent where there were a couple of officers and actually kill them. And there was so much resentment of the people who were over there in Vietnam. Our soldiers understood we weren't there to win that war. And I can tell you from firsthand experience, having been personally told by Ambassador William H. Sullivan, the American ambassador to Laos during the Vietnam War, and by four-star Marine General Lewis Walt. General Walt and Ambassador Sullivan both told me we could have ended the war in 6 weeks. All we had to do was invade North Vietnam, where we were never allowed to. We didn't go to Vietnam to win. We went there as a great diversion. And how do I know that? Why? Because McGeorge Bundy, head of the National Security Council, wrote the article on this. It's in the January issue of January 1967 issue of Foreign Affairs magazine. It's called The End of Either Or, and if you read the last two pages of the article, he will tell you that the road forward at home is not by retreat in Vietnam. We've got to stay in Vietnam. If we pull out of Vietnam, there'll be a reaction to all of our domestic policies. If you believe in this great new departures in health and education and welfare, if you really believe in rebuilding America, don't say we ought to get out of Vietnam, for the opposite is the case. The road forward at home is by persistence in Vietnam, and a pullout in Vietnam would lead to strong domestic opposition to our policies. Now, that was McGeorge Bundy, member of Skull and Bones, National Security Advisor to the President of the United States, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and Vietnam was simply a diversion while they brought in the Great Society. And 58,000, and perhaps many more, according to Douglas, died as a result of that no-win war, a war we were never allowed to win. And all during that war, we were funding Russia with both military and with military supplies and financially, so they could fund the North Vietnamese, so the North Vietnamese could fund the Viet Cong for killing our boys. Go right ahead, Douglas.
Yes, sir. It's important to emphasize that when many men actually talk about their Vietnam experience, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, many of these men are speaking the truth, because at 1968, the height of the Vietnam War, during the time of the year of the Tet Offensive, there were well over 500,000 men who were in country Vietnam, directly in theater. So we're talking about well over 600,000 men at the time. And of those men, when you circulate that, when you count the fact that they were only in area for 9 months at a time, the average tour of duty was a year, 3 months of which was spent in boot camp. So they're cycling these men constantly. The end result is, when you have that many men cycling 9 months at a time, there were well over 7 to 8 to 10 million men who served in Vietnam during the period of time that we were there. And we were involved starting in 1945. The first OSS officer was killed in 1945 in Vietnam. Then we were there through the 1950s as advisors. And, of course, we were there actually till 1975 with the fall of Saigon.
Basically, of course, a figure I've seen is 10 million men rotated through Vietnam during those years. Go right ahead.
That's correct, sir. And that is the at least acknowledged. And it was more than that. What happens is, when these men claim to be Vietnam veterans according to the U.S. Census, 90% of them are counted by the U.S. government as liars, because they claim that there were far less. So we have a huge dichotomy between what the U.S. government will acknowledge and the men who were in theater. That's another factor which I bring in concerning the wall, which, by the way, was designed by a relative of mine, Maya Ying Lin. Maya Ying Lin is a very distant relative of mine. She has the same Chinese last name as my mother. So without that individual, the Americans would not even have a wall on which to acknowledge those who are acknowledged. So I know something of what I am speaking. The end result that I'm pointing out is, the officer class was decimated enough so that men like Colonel Aquino could take advantage of it. Things went further in his direction with the so-called officer's massacre, in which many children were molested at various bases in the United States, and many Christian officers resigned in protest, and then many men who were part of the cultic initiation rites of the Temple of Set, and various satanic circles of which Colonel Aquino was responsible for, came to the fore, stepped in, and pretty much overtook a lot of the command of our military structure. This is why they were influential enough so that when Colonel Aquino was retired, he was approached and he wrote the chaplain's handbook for all of the chaplains in the United States Army. This is indisputable fact, and I've taken that chaplain's handbook, segments of it, and I posted it on my Facebook, which is accessible through DouglasDietrich.com. You can just go there, and there's the big Facebook button, big blue F button, and you can press on that. It'll take you right to my public timeline. I've posted it various times. I might post it again in the near future, but all people need to do is scroll down through the various months. My public timeline hasn't been up for that long. They'll find various references to Colonel Aquino and the actual citations from that chaplain's handbook, which is also available on the net. People can track it down by just tracking down Colonel Aquino, author, chaplain's handbook, U.S. Army.
Well, Douglas, do they have satanic chaplains in the military today?
They do. They do. And this is the result of Colonel Aquino. In a sense, he pioneered it for other alternative religions as well, such as Buddhist, such as Wiccan. It's not necessarily all progress was necessarily negative, depending on one's level of religious tolerance. But the chaplain's handbook was written so that whatever your religion, Buddhist, Wiccan, Jewish, Catholic, Protestant, you would have to make certain not to disrespect the satanic rituals. That's why he was chosen to write the chaplain's handbook.
I think people have to understand that my understanding is that today a Christian chaplain cannot pray in the name of Jesus Christ. We know that the military commanders cannot lead their troops in prayer. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. America had a great military because we were a Christian nation. We're no longer a Christian nation. Go right ahead, Douglas.
Yes, sir. Well, to emphasize the extent of his influence, that by the time that I went to war, and of course I was in the Marine Corps, not the Army, the Army in particular was led by the so-called Jedi Knights, who were products of SAM, the School of Advanced Military Study. But many Marines trained there as well. And this is in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. And we had men over there like Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Challens, who I'm sure made it to full colonel. And I don't know if he's still in the military. I'd be surprised if he still is. But at any rate, a direct quote from him in how he was indoctrinating the so-called Jedi Knights who led us into Operation Desert Storm in 1991 went like this, and it's not a paraphrase, it's a direct quote. I memorized it. The Bible is one of the most genocidal books ever written. The necessary illusion propagated currently is that the Islamic faith is somehow more dangerous and violent than the Christian faith. I would argue that all of the Abrahamic religions are equally dangerous because they are all based on faith, which is by definition the lack of reason. And so he was indoctrinating our military leaders in this school of thought, which puts a total lie to the concept of Christian crusaders in the Holy Land stepping onto the soil of Al-Makkah and Al-Madinah and somehow violating the sanctity of the House of Saud. And putting that into perspective, this is the kind of leadership that the military suffers under today, which is one reason why our military was so eager to sacrifice all of their troops with the anthrax injection that all of us received. Basically, that the vaccine was essentially had an additive, an adjuvant, an oil called squalene, which stimulated the immune system. And squalene causes autoimmune diseases, chronic and life-threatening illnesses like lupus, crippling arthritis, multiple sclerosis. And this is the stuff that military doctors secretly injected into Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine personnel and pretty much devastated the entire armed services.
Basically, don't you think, though, that there are many military officers who are Christians and certainly are good people?
Yes. My father certainly was in the military for well over 30 years, and I think of him as a good man. I certainly don't think of myself as an inherently evil individual, and I was in the military for a comparatively very short period of time, less than 2 years. And, of course, there are good men in the military, and it's important to make that distinction. Oftentimes, when I talk about crimes of the United States and what the United States did under the influence of the invisible government, that's not a condemnation of the American people. So that certainly needs to be understood. But with that in mind, sir, would you like to, again, kind of review just how this took us to the what happened with the Spanish flu? I'm not quite sure if we're speaking to the same audience or if they need to hear kind of a review of
you
that.
You know, there's nothing wrong with a review because I think your story of a certain I knew very well that the Spanish flu had begun not in Spain. It had begun here in the United States. It had begun within our military. And, of course, sir, when you had large units of the American military who were coming down with this influenza, and the medical officers asked the superior officers not to keep these patients certainly in isolation until the flu was gone, certainly not to send them to Europe. Why, they did exactly the opposite. They put them into boats, they shipped them to Europe, a lot of people died, and now they were spreading the influenza all over Europe, and it never made sense. I always knew there was another cause behind it, and that is why I was really so fascinated with the information that you brought out in one of your treatises, and we're going to be back in just a moment, and I want you to review that. Go right ahead.
Yes, sir.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I asked Sidney Douglas to review his treatise on the spread of the Spanish flu. Now, the Spanish flu was probably the worst influenza epidemic that the world had ever seen. Remember, during the Second World War, 20 million people died. 8 million were military. About 12, 13 million of them were civilians. It was a terrible and horrible and bloody, devastating war. Of course, following the war, then, of course, the communists came to power and they started their extermination over in Russia. The First World War destroyed the Russian Empire and the German Empire and the Ottoman Empire and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and certainly devastated Italy and France and England. But of course, that was the real purpose behind it. But at the end of the First World War, there was this sudden onset of a flu, unlike anything we'd seen before, where at least 20 million people died. And, of course, more recent figures, they're increasing this, telling us it was 100 million. I can remember, of course, the old figures. The new figures, there's a great deal of information now suggesting that the initial estimates of the number of people who died was much less. In other words, they figured only 20 million died, and they now are saying 50 to 100 million people died. But you pick up the story as to how this came about, because obviously, as I've always suspected, this was a contrived epidemic. Go right ahead, Douglas.
Yes, sir. Well, it's important to remember that a military doctor is far different from a civilian doctor. A civilian doctor such as Dr. Stanley Monteith is trained to respect patients' rights and to make sure that they do everything to heal a patient and to do no harm. That is the first rule of medicine that would be obeyed by your standard doctor. Military doctor is different because the physician in the military is trained by the military. And where I accessed these records was as a Department of Defense research librarian who was liaising not only with the main postal library, but also with the Letterman Army Medical Center Library. And the Letterman Army Medical Center was one of the most advanced military training centers for doctors in the world. 25% of all the United States Army doctors were trained there. So I got very acquainted with their procedures. And the military doctor accepts the obligation to place military interests over his own interests and those he might otherwise have a civilian doctor when he becomes a military officer. In this sense, he's primarily a soldier with special technical expertise. So this was the reason for many doctors to become conscientious objectors during the Vietnam War, for instance, and they would bring up the fact that the military physician is a soldier first and a doctor second. And as a result, they discovered the efficacy of biological warfare during the Indian Wars from 1790 to 1898, while much of the nation was nominally at peace. The Indian Wars were a fixture of life. Basically, except for the War of 1812, the Mexican War, and the Civil War, they occupied the army chronically. For 30 bloody years after Appomattox, Indian fighting was year-round, and there were 1,400 battles fought, nearly one a week by the U.S. Army. And in order to finally exterminate what they considered to be a menace of savages to protect frontier women and children, they instituted biological warfare. When they were marching them on various trails of tears to reservations, they would pass out blankets that were loaded with smallpox. The end result was they exterminated 100,000 American Indians.
Well, basically, these were blankets that had been used by people who had smallpox. They had the virus in them, and they knew that, and they intentionally infected the Indians who had no resistance to this disease. And they came down with the disease, and many of them died. 100,000, I wouldn't be at all surprised. It was an act of genocide carried out by the American military against the Indians. The Indians know about this. The average American has never heard of it. Go right ahead.
Yes, sir. Well, by the time of World War One, Germany won the Second World War and the First World War. And the First World War was not drawing to a close. It was actually just beginning. They had won the First World War on the Eastern Front. They had defeated the Tsar. The Bolsheviks had overtaken the former Tsarist government after its abdication. And they honored a treaty known as the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. And the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk basically surrendered one-third, or 33%, of all of Russia's population to Germany, 25%, a quarter of her territory to Germany, and over half, 50% of her industry to Germany. So with all of this, the Kaiser's position was unassailable. He was turning towards the West, and the Western response in America was to develop a weapon of mass destruction.
Now, basically, of course, now the Kaiser that was going to bring his troops off the Eastern Front, and it sort of launched them against the French against the English and against the American troops that were there. And, of course, the Kaiser had never wanted this war. He had tried to get out of the war repeatedly. He had sued for peace. But, of course, Colonel House, who was representing what I call the Brotherhood, was there rejecting all of those offers. There was no reason for America to have gone into the war. But they wanted to kill as many people as they could. I'm talking about Colonel House and his confreres, so that we could get the League of Nations and bring in a world government. That was the common denominator behind that war and the other wars. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is Douglas Dietrich, and basically we're talking about, of course, the origin of the great influenza that followed the First World War, or perhaps that brought an end to the First World War. Somebody had called in and said they thought all wars were fought over land. Well, if you listen to our programs, you'll find out that all the wars of recent, the last century or more, have been fought to bring about a global government, because there's a small group working behind the scenes whose major goal and purpose is to bring about a one-world government. And if you believe all wars are fought for land, let me suggest you get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and read it and reread it, and then check out all the documents that we have written by people who've studied this, and many of them even affiliated with the secret societies working behind the scenes, whose purpose and goal is world government. Well, Douglas, why don't you just go ahead and certainly tell us, you begin to start telling us about the origin of the great influenza that came about following World War One, or that came about as World War One was being drawing to an end. Go right ahead, Douglas.
Yes, sir. Actually, World War One was reaching the peak of its intensity, and the Kaiser was just beginning a full-scale assault by moving all of his assets onto the Western Front, where he could put an end to the war once and for all with a clean sweep to the Atlantic. And he now had the resources in terms of manpower and industry of Russia behind him that had been surrendered to him through the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. And that's spelled Brest-Litovsk. And with that in mind, the Americans realized that with a small expeditionary force, comparatively speaking, that they were going to throw across the Atlantic, that they were in no way going to be able to stop this. Nothing was going to unseat the Kaiser's government short of an atomic bomb on Berlin, which at that time didn't exist. It's also important to emphasize that by Hitler's time it would not have worked because his bunker system was deep enough where he would have survived despite the deployment of an atomic bomb. So in terms of the Kaiser, the Americans incepted the avian flu. Now, this is known as H1N1, hemagglutinin 1, neuromodase 1, H1N1. All flus are avian flus because all of the humanity is basically nothing to viruses. They prefer avian population, which gives them an enormous biomass in which to continue to mutate. The way that it usually gets into people is out of Asia, where they live very close with their poultry, their chickens. They also live very closely with their swine, their pigs, on subsistence-level agriculture, even today in most areas of Asia. And by the fecal matter and the particulate matter from the feathers of the chickens getting it near the pigs and the pigs devouring it, getting eaten in turn by the humans, all flus sweep out of Asia as essentially avian/swine flus. So the term avian or swine flu is actually a misnomer. They're all avian swine flus. So knowing this, the American government took conscripts out of San Quentin in the very state of California where I currently reside. They shipped them in unrefrigerated boxcars on trains with live chickens in cages where they were inhaling all of that particulate fecal matter and basically shredded feathers, etc., the shedded feathers, and were getting into their lung system, etc.
But Douglas, are you suggesting that they were intentionally trying to spread this avian flu into human beings? Basically, of course, the avian flu is deadly as far as birds are concerned, and it's deadly to human beings, but it's not readily transmissible to human beings. And, of course, this is certainly fortunate, because otherwise, if we got this deadly flu, why, we'd have a tremendous increase in the incidence of death following the avian flu. But since it didn't spread ordinarily to human beings, you suggested that they actually took these prisoners and had them transported along with these birds who were obviously sick so that they would be able to introduce this deadly disease into the human species?
Absolutely, because the military's use of experimental medicine is as old as the nation itself. The first U.S. military commander to order the use of experimental medical procedures was none other than General George Washington. When smallpox struck the Northern Department of the Continental Army in 1775, it had 10,000 troops, and basically about half of them, over half, 5,500 of them, became casualties of smallpox. So they introduced variolation, which was a vaccination under a primitive form, by taking a bit of the smallpox and introducing it into open wounds of uninfected soldiers so that they would get a milder case of the smallpox. So even in 1776, we knew about the effect of preventing diseases, and military doctors knew how to cause them.
That was long before Jenner came up with the idea of using cowpox, but I think you're absolutely right. I've heard that before. So actually, they had known how to vaccinate against smallpox even during the time of the Revolutionary War. But go right ahead. Now we're certainly at the end of the, or moving it certainly towards the end of World War One, and you're suggesting that there were people who were actually then transporting convicts from California on boxcars. And in those boxcars were a lot of sick birds who had the avian flu, with the idea of actually spreading this disease into the human species. Is that it?
Absolutely. And by the time they reached Fort Lewis, Kansas, Many of these convicts were infected. The problem was the kill ratio was so high that it was hard to bioweaponize it. You need a 10 to 20% fatality or mortality ratio for a disease to be applicable as a bioweapon. Avian flu is a variant of hemorrhagic fever, and what it causes is a cytokinetic storm in the lungs of anyone who's not an infant or a senior citizen. If you have a strong, healthy immune system, you're in more danger than anyone else. Infants and seniors are in far less danger of these kinds of flus because their immunosystems are either not developed enough or they're too weak to respond aggressively. With a young, healthy individual, then the response to the flu is deadly because your immunosystem overreacts and literally melts the lungs, and you cough up pink phlegm, which is literally your dissolved lungs out of your mouth. You die within 24 hours. So the end result of that is it can't spread very well. So by the time they were able to get them all at Fort Lewis, Kansas, and stick 56,000 new recruits at a hastily built cantonment called Camp Funston on the Fort Riley Military Reservation in Haskell County, Kansas, the same place where the School of Advanced Military Studies, where that Colonel Challen that I was speaking of, was indoctrinating the Jedi Knights that led us into Operation Desert Storm, which ought to give you kind of a very chilling idea of that whole military environment of Kansas, which is quite dark and has a sickening history, quite literally. They were able to finally stabilize this into a lower kill ratio. And the index patient was ultimately identified as a man named Albert Gitchell. His family name was spelled G-I-T-C-H-E-L-L. And he was basically noted in the logs that I was collating at the Letterman Army Medical Center as the index patient, meaning that he manifested the disease with a 10 to 20% mortality ratio. So they made him cook, and they had him feed 56,000 new recruits at this cantonment, and that's how they spread the disease. The civilian doctors, of course, were insisting that you needed to isolate these men. They refused to do so. They made them sleep together. They also made them continue to eat these chickens, clean their waste products, clean the cages, etc. And of course, Gitchell was cooking these chickens. The end result was, of course, what was known in these logs in the military nomenclature as the Army flu.
Now, I think it's so vitally important that our listeners understand you stop the spread of a communicable disease by isolating the people who have the disease so they can't spread it to others. This is what we should have done with the AIDS epidemic. We did not. We specifically did not because they wanted the AIDS epidemic to spread. But because that was something that happened certainly in the 1980s. But we're looking back and certainly the period there, certainly 1917. They knew exactly what to do at that time. The Army doctors wanted to isolate the patients with the flu, and of course they were blocked by their superior officers, and they took these soldiers, these infected soldiers, they put them with uninfected soldiers onto troop ships, they shipped them to Europe, they disseminated them all over Europe, and of course this spread this disease all over Europe, and of course it got into the German military as well. Pick up the story there, Douglas, because this is one of the most frightening and horrible examples of the evil that we're up against today. Go right ahead.
Yes, sir. What happened was they shipped these troops across the Atlantic while they were infected. They arrived in nominally neutral Spain in what were known as coffin ships. The vast majority of the American expeditionary forces arrived dead. And because they disembarked in Spain, which played fast and loose with its neutrality, it became known as the Spanish flu. Of course, the surviving troops went to France, carried it to the French, and then ultimately to the Germans. And the conditions of 4 years of war in the trenches had already made men inured to machine gun fire. They were charging live machine gun fire and losing up to 60,000 men in a day. All of these men were frightened not of dying by bullet or bayonet or explosion. They were frightened of catching the flu. And there was blowback. 20 million American men died at home, died at on the American home front. There were two waves within weeks of the so-called Spanish flu, known in the Letterman Army Medical Center logs as the Army flu. It was truly an American flu. And the Americans who caught it were dying so quickly that the coffins ran out in a week. In the city of Philadelphia, for instance, they basically had to bury people in mass graves without coffins, and they soon had to start using steam shovels to dig these graves to keep up with the pace of the incoming bodies. To put this into perspective for you, the Spanish flu basically killed 100 million people worldwide. It edged out the Black Plague in terms of fatality ratios. It killed more people in 24 hours than AIDS has killed in 24 years. It killed more people in a single year than the Black Death of the Middle Ages killed in an entire century. This was a weapon. It was a bioweapon, and it won the Americans the First World War. Basically, the German industry, because of people catching flus back home, no one could man the factories to produce munitions for the troops at the front. Troops on the front were dying. The end result was the Germans had to sue for peace, even while they were in a position of ultimate victory and had to suffer the consequences of the Versailles Diktat, which ultimately was so unjust and so monstrous in terms of its demands that it led to the voting in of the Nazis. So that's how impacting this flu was. It was the most deadly, the greatest so-called natural disaster in history, and there was nothing natural about it. This was something that is truly monstrous in terms of its implications and literally impacted the genetics of the human race. So many people died that it altered the type of human being that lives today, because there's a certain kind of human being that did not have the ability in terms of immunoreaction to withstand that onslaught of the avian flu, that it altered the kind of population that we have, quite literally. So this is how monstrous the effects of this was. And with your permission, Doctor, we could go on to other examples of bioweaponization. But
all right, why don't you go right ahead, Dave Douglas?
Yeah. Well, in terms of other examples of bioweaponization, this is why the Americans started Camp Dietrich around the time of the Second World War, when the Americans knew that the Second World War was approaching, because the Americans were doing everything they could to start it under the Roosevelt Socialist Administration. They basically chose a man named George W. Merck, the president of a drug company. Merck was a household name, still is today. An entire generation, several generations of physicians have come to rely on the so-called Merck Manual as a trusted guide for diagnosing and treating disease. And this man, Merck, was put in charge of America's bioweaponization program. And this was far more secret than the atomic bomb. You are lied to all throughout your education when you're told that the Manhattan Project was the absolute limit of top-secret projects. Everyone knows about the Manhattan Project. You can find out anything you want about the Manhattan Project, except for the human experimentation aspects of it. But you even had a truck driver in terms of the bombs named John Kostermullen, who built an exact working duplicate replica of both Fat Man and Little Boy. The only thing he was missing was the active fissionable plutonium or uranium for either bomb. But in terms of Fort Dietrich, no one knows what was going on in World War II.
All right, before we go on, is the story that you put out as far as the origin of the avian flu epidemic that certainly led to the end of World War I, is that written out, or have you ever written this out? Because, of course, the information is fascinating. I've always suspected something like this was at hand. But is this written up any place, or when, of course, you were working there, did they destroy all of these records?
These records were all destroyed, but a good deal of the results are written about in popularly accessible books, such as the New York Times bestseller, The Great Influenza, which was written by John M. Barry. His last name is spelled B-A-R-R-Y. The problem is that it's a sanitized book. There are no villains in this book, and he doesn't portray the reality of the inception of the flu. He portrays basically how deadly it was, and basically portrays a number of the researchers involved in trying to, quote-unquote, identify the causes, etc. In this sense, it's a very misleading book, and I'm not saying that Barry is intentionally some kind of villain or propagandist. He's working with what he has available. The problem is what academia or journalists have available when they investigate these subjects is only what the Department of Defense has released.
When was that book, The Great Epidemic, come out?
The Great Influenza.
The Great Influenza, okay.
I'm trying to remember. I apologize, sir, but I believe it came out fairly recently. I'd say it was probably around 2004.
Oh, is that Darry, D-A-R-R-Y?
Barry, B-A-R-R-Y.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, sir. And with your permission also, I'd like to go a bit into my website and then finish up with what I was saying about Camp Dietrich. That would be important.
Once you get your website out here so our listeners will know how to get your material.
Yes, sir. My website is www.douglasdietrich.com. Douglas is spelled with one S. Dietrich, my family name, is spelled exactly like the famous actress Marlena Dietrich. If you're too young to remember who she is, it just put the word diet and rich together, D-I-E-T-R-I-C-H. So DouglasDietRich.com. And while you're there, you can access, if you'd like, the DVD set that we're selling until we're all out. We're basically had another run just made for the holidays because the demand, fortunately, was high enough, but it's still very little. And we're once they're out, we're never going to re-release them again because we're trying to analog them into printed text. And one of them is Roswell and the Rising Sun, which led directly to the death of my mother and talks about the use of Japanese prisoners of war and the collateral damage while America and Japan were still legally at war, which lasted until the Treaty of San Francisco went into effect April 27th of 1952. It's important to remember that, that the war with Japan and America continued legally until then. Other than that, the other DVD in the set is Satan's Crusaders, which speaks very deeply about the influence of Colonel Aquino and Satanism on our military, why it's degenerated into the condition that it has today, chewing up our soldiers and the lives of civilians overseas and at home. And that contains photos that you will not find anywhere else, photos of satanic sacrifices on site, the Presidio military base, which I took with a spy camera. So both DVDs are for the price of one, and until they run out, which will be quite soon. So do check into that, DouglasDietrich.com. Also investigate Nexus Magazine, where I have three articles in a row in the last three issues concerning the Third Reich in Exile, NexusMagazine.com. And you can download those articles for $1.50 each. I don't make a dime off of that.
That's where is the Third Reich, or what happened to the Third Reich? You say the Third Reich in exile. What are you speaking of?
The exile government of the Third Reich became very similar to the Nationalist Republic of China, which reestablished itself on Taiwan. In this case, it established itself outside of Europe. And originally,
are you speaking of Argentina, Chile, down Paraguay?
Initially, yes, sir.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, Douglas, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Yes, sir. I'd like to emphasize the fact that unlike the atomic bomb, Camp Dietrich actually had real security in terms of the 250 buildings and 5,000 people who worked there starting in 1942, long before the Manhattan Project got underway in late 42, early 43, was surrounded by guards that had machine guns, were ordered to shoot first and ask questions later. The scientists themselves were all issued pistols, which they kept at their sides or nearby on workbenches. The headquarters building had its own set of armed guards. Scientists all had identity passes with first employee photos. This was a security precaution that was the first to be used anywhere in the United States. Certainly wasn't used at Los Alamos. So this was where the real action was taking place. And the sense of that race to build biological weapons to win the Second World War, the Americans lost. Because Emperor Hirohito of the Empire of Japan was a marine biologist, he won the race first in terms of bio-weaponizing a true weapon of mass destruction out of bacteria. In this case, it was the what was known as a botulinum toxin, so poisonous that 1 pound, if distributed, could kill 1 billion people. And so that is what essentially won the war, and that's what led to talk down processes. That's why America and Japan were legally at war until 1952. That's part of a hidden history that modern Americans need to learn to come to grips with. They have been terribly misled by their government, which has led to a brain drain of their own scientists and professionals going into engineering of radiological weapons and nuclear missiles, which had nothing to do with winning the Second World War, but have led to a welfare state and permanent employment program for physicists and engineers for the past half century.
Well, now, are you speaking of the Second World War or the First World War?
The second in this case, sir.
All right, fine. And what did they do biologically for the Second World War?
Well, in terms of Emperor Hirohito of Japan, he was a marine biologist. He had developed biocidal weapons and, again, took down their virility, their mortality ratios to the point where they were viable weapons. In China, he kept the mortality ratios very high. He wiped out the entire Chinese 5th and 6th armies by Japanese biological weapons fired from porcelain shells, literally from artillery. That's how well he got
them. Well, we're going to have to cover that another evening. We're almost out of time. Do you have a telephone number where people could get contact you for your DVDs?
There is one on the website. So if you actually go to
For people who don't have the website, do you have that telephone number? Somebody had called in, doesn't have access to the internet or the web.
Oh, darn.
Do you have that telephone number?
I do, sir. Let me look that up while we speak to your kind audience. I want to thank them all for their infinite patience.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in a moment here.
Yes, sir.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening has been Douglas Dietrich. A lot of fascinating information. Of course, we know that certainly about some of the biological warfare experiments were carried out on the Chinese at the end of the Second World War. And as certainly we'll be getting Douglas back again and talking about some more of this information, because it's vitally important. You understand that nothing is as it appears to be. Recently, within the last 6 months, why the federal government acknowledged that it had paid some of our scientists millions of dollars to find out how they could take the deadly avian flu virus, which is spread readily among birds, and actually transmit that to human beings. In other words, it's deadly when it gets into humans, but humans don't contract it, and if they do contract it, they don't spread it to others. So how could you make this deadly disease communicable to human beings? And they found out how to do it. And then they had this long discussion whether that the results of the scientific studies should be actually published, you know, in scientific journals, or should be suppressed because this is such a horrible thing that they would actually have the ability to take this deadly avian virus and get it into human beings. And so they raged back and forth on the debate whether this should or should not be published, totally ignoring the fact is, why would our government spend millions of dollars to find out how to make a deadly avian flu virus communicable among human beings? Nobody ever asked that, and I will tell you why, ladies and gentlemen, because down the line we're going to have terrible avian flu epidemics among human beings. As we're told in the Bible, hundreds of millions of people are going to die. In Revelation 6:8, you learn that a quarter of the population of the world is going to be exterminated. And then Revelation 6:9, another third of the world is to be exterminated. And I do believe they're going to use some of these terrible weapons. But don't take my word for it. Get your Bible out. Revelation 6:8, Revelation 6:9. Douglas, do you have that telephone number where people can actually call and get your information?
Yes, sir. That would be 415 area code 895-6069. Once again, that would be 1-415/895-6069. You'll get Laughing Communications, and Lorian Fenton, my manageress, will be the individual who either answers or you'll get her answering service. Leave a message and she will get back to you immediately. Want to verify what Dr. Stanley Montes is saying? The modern day equivalent of the 100 million people killed in World War I, which ended that war with a super weapon, the avian flu, the modern equivalent of that would be 1 billion people dead and another 1 billion people whose lives would be shortened by at least 15 years due to the lung damage that would be caused by surviving the avian flu.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're out of time. I want to thank you so very much for being with us, Douglas. We'll get you back on again. But I think it's vitally important, ladies and gentlemen, that you understand there really are evil and wicked people out there. And if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, I suggest you get it. Of course, the book is incomplete because I did not understand that AIDS, it was a man-made disease when I wrote the book, but it is, and there's no question of that. We have the documentation on that. AIDS was a man-made disease specifically designed to kill hundreds of millions of people, but it failed. It really is not, has only killed maybe 30 million at the most so far, another 30 million infected. But believe me, they're working on other very effective means of killing off large parts of the population. For those of you who need more information, let me suggest my talk on Agenda 21. The Covert Plan, Agenda 21, The Covert Plan. Let me suggest my talk on Population Control, The Covert Agenda. Certainly, you go to the internet and pull down my talk on the Population Control Agenda. It is simply a treatise that's on the internet. And then, of course, we actually have the of my Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, to see how it all fits together. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Oh, if you can afford to certainly help Radio Liberty financially so we can stay on the air, we'd love to hear from you. And if not, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.